What's up, Bills Mafia? It's Joe Marino from the Draft Network, and I am your host of Locked On Bills. Happy Tuesday to you. If you're listening to this, I'm in Indianapolis getting ready to cover the 2020 NFL Scouting Combine. All the big NFL prospects are in town. We'll get a chance to interview them, a chance to watch them do drills on the field, and a big part of the evaluation process overall. Another big part of what I get to do in Indianapolis is get a chance to interview Sean McDermott and Brandon Bean. So tomorrow on this podcast, I'm going to be spending some time reflecting on their comments, and the rest of the week we're really going to be combine heavy with what I'm learning, what I'm hearing, and how all of that ties back to the Buffalo Bills. But today, as you know, we're going to continue our series with Bruce Nolan about the potential in-house options for the Bills to use players that already exist on the roster to fill these holes that exist on the roster as we enter, you know, free agency here in a couple of weeks. The draft is a few more weeks from that, but it's always important to consider what you already have and if these guys can claim some meaningful roles. We did this yesterday offensively. Today is defense. Bruce, welcome back.
Hey, Joe, great to have me again. Great to be here again. It's fun to have this discussion. I think it's a nice little topic that a lot of people don't get a chance to talk about the way that they want to. And because you can't necessarily plug all holes via acquisition. Sometimes you plug them via other methods. And one of the ways is next man up.
Bruce, this is what, four? You're going to have four podcasts this week and two articles?
Yes. It'll be two pods with you, the Nick and Nolan, which is twice, and then I'll have two articles. In fact, when the combine starts, I'll have an article dropping every night about standouts from each position group. So I'll have multiple articles every day of the combine. Yeah.
So this is, we thought Bruce week was like, when was it? Like a couple weeks after the season? This is the real Bruce week.
This is the actual Bruce week. This is the time to completely tune out if you do not like to listen to my voice or read any of my content.
My guess is that if those people that exist, I'm sure they do, right? That's part of having a personality is people hate you. So those people exist. They're not listening right now, Bruce. They heard you yesterday.
They stole my name and they didn't press on this one.
Yeah, they're not back. They're not back. This is a safe zone. We've got fans only here today as we shift our attention to the defensive side of the football. Let's start up front, defensive end. I've talked a lot about I want impact players at defensive end. It's a premium position. I want guys that make big impacts. And Jerry Hughes is aging. Trent Murphy's in a contract year. He can be cut and the Bills could save like $8 million. Shaq Lawson's a free agent as of the recording of this podcast. I want to look at some of these options, and there's not a whole lot of options to consider other than Darryl Johnson, the Bills' seventh round pick in 2019. Had some flashy moments in preseason. Played about 20% of the defensive snaps, and he was a four-phase special teams player. So he has a meaningful role, but can he be the impact guy that I'm looking for at pass rusher, at least in terms of, you know, situationally, whether that's filling in for the Lorenzo Alexander role as a pass rusher? Where are we at with Darryl Johnson in terms of your appeal for him claiming a bigger role and your prediction, if you will?
With Darryl Johnson, I would put the probability as being highly unlikely, and I would put my appetite or the appeal to me as being highly unappealing, both for the same reason. Darryl Johnson is toolsy. He's a toolsy project from a lower level of competition, and I don't think 1 year is enough. Not because he's not capable of ever being a player who can contribute, but I don't think 1 year is sufficient for a player who you take in the seventh round specifically and almost entirely based on the ability to show enough burst, enough bend, and good physical length. And that's the thing that Darryl Johnson get. When you pick a Darryl Johnson in the seventh round, you are picking a lump of clay. You're saying, okay, he doesn't necessarily exhibit a ton of the things that we need to see to be an impact pass rusher, but he could exhibit those things. If we teach him to use the length better, if we maybe put a few more pounds on the guy, if he goes through one or two off seasons of a NFL offseason conditioning and strength program, maybe we could have something. The reason why it's highly unlikely and highly unappealing to me is both for the same reason. And it's because I don't think he's a one-year project. I think he's a multiple-year project.
All right, so a player that maybe after next season we talk about claiming a bigger role, but Bruce, I keep saying this. I want impact, high impact players at defensive end. And I just don't see many of those on the roster unless Jerry Hughes is going to play like he did against Laramie Tunsil in that playoff game. That'd be nice to see more consistently. Okay, so that's about it, right? Mike Love's coming back. I don't think you're going to have much to say about him in terms of claiming a bigger role. So I want to shift gears now to the interior defensive line, the three technique position. Ed Oliver's the guy, right? He's the present and the future of that position. The top 10 pick from last year really came on as the season went along. He's your guy. Jordan Phillips, free agent. And you and I have both written articles and talked openly on a podcast about why we don't think he'll be back. And so operating under that belief that Jordan Phillips is not back as a backup three technique to Ed Oliver, looking at the current roster, there's a guy that I thought was at least interesting that came out of Oklahoma State, played okay for the Miami Dolphins for some limited reps there, but he was on the team this year. We got a good look at him, at least in terms of having him in the building and evaluating his habits and thinking about if he can claim a bigger role. I'm referring to Vincent Taylor. Is there any thought to on your behalf that he could be the answer at backup three tech?
I have Vincent Taylor as somewhat unlikely, but somewhat appealing. So the reason I have him as somewhat unlikely is I think that Vincent Taylor would have gotten more run over maybe some sub-package players that typically got, I mean, Corey Legit was kind of getting run over him. I think Vincent Taylor, if we were thinking about him as an organization, as someone who could potentially take over in the event that Jordan Phillips were to walk, I think we would have seen more of him and less of Corey Legit down the stretch. In addition, he hasn't been in the building long. Now, it's nice to get him in the building, but I think it's somewhat unlikely that he ends up stepping up as the backup three tech. However, that doesn't mean it's not appealing to me, because it is. It is somewhat appealing to me. I mean, people forget first team All Big 12, 7 sacks as a junior. He declared early, so there's still some things to work on there. We've talked about three tech defensive tackle not necessarily being a fast developing position in the NFL. You could make an argument in 2018. There are Miami beat writers who think he was the best defensive tackle on the team in 2018. Now, part of that speaks to the fact that they just had not great resources and talent in that position. But I think there's something there for Vincent Taylor. He has the right body composition. I liked him as kind of a mid to later round sort of project defensive tackle coming out of Oklahoma State. And I think that there's something there, especially as he's multiple years into his career. I actually feel better about him now than I would have taking a late round flyer on him back when he got drafted. So there is somewhat appealing to me for Vincent Taylor to be the backup three tech to Ed Oliver.
I share some of that intrigue with you on Vincent Taylor. One thing you said there that, I don't know, triggered me, maybe that's the wrong word, but at least provoked a thought. You started talking about why, you know, that he wasn't really given that opportunity late in the season, and they brought in Corey Legit. Do you think that if the Bills weren't in the playoff hunt, or, you know, really a team that was probably going to make the playoffs, you know, once they had that really hot start, did that come down to more just wanting that experienced vet, or do you think it was more of an indictment on Vincent Taylor?
I think it's probably a risk move. You know, bring in someone who we know is a vet and we know can play, because at the time, Vincent Taylor had only been on the team for a couple weeks. And at that time, you're like, listen, I don't want to put all my eggs in the basket of this Vincent Taylor guy. But when Corey Legit comes in and now he's getting more and more run over you, when you can see both of them in practice every day, it just kind of makes me wonder. You know, I think there might be a higher probability, in my opinion, that Corey Legit gets re-signed as the backup three tech, then Vincent Taylor steps up as being that from an organizational standpoint. I'm actually completely okay. Like I said, there's appeal there. But from an organizational standpoint, it just seems like they're telling us that they prefer Legit. Now, when they brought him in, that was primarily we're not going to put all our eggs in this Vincent Taylor guy's basket. But then the longer that goes on, the lesser that reason becomes, because now they have an opportunity to see them both next to each other every day in practice, and they keep picking Legit over Taylor.
Yeah, it's a very interesting way to put that, and we'll see how that unfolds. If Legit's brought back, I think that's a pretty loud message, right? If they bring back him, he's an expiring contract. If Legit signs back, then it's probably not a good sign for Vincent Taylor. Let's shift gears now to Sam linebacker. Lorenzo Alexander's retired. I talked at length about that on a podcast last week on Wednesday, where I did the performance review series on the linebackers and talked about Lorenzo Alexander's role specifically as a Sam linebacker when the Bills are in 4-3 base defense. And part of that conversation was teasing that we would touch on this more in depth today. So anxious to get your thoughts on if the Bills have an option in-house to step in and fill those snaps and play well in replacement of Zoe this year. I want to start with Corey Thompson, who seems like he's well-liked by this coaching staff.
I have Corey Thompson as being somewhat likely and somewhat appealing. Him being the first guy off the bench at multiple linebacker spots indicates to me that there's organizational affection for Corey Thompson, especially the way he was talked about from Sean McDermott during the offseason. And then you go into the regular season, nobody really gets hurt. So you don't really have a lot of that. Matt Milano missed a game, but Tremaine Edmonds played over 95% of the snaps, and you didn't really have an opportunity to see if Corey Thompson was well thought of by the staff as being someone who'd be the next man up. But I think he'll get every crack at it because they believe in bringing in people. They believe in developing them. And Corey Thompson has already had the positive pub that would be necessary for him to get that first crack at it. You know, they're going to give him an opportunity to lose the job. I do think that there's potential that Corey Thompson could be hindered by the Ike Butker syndrome. He was bit by the Ike Butker syndrome. And so the problem there is he's too versatile for his own good. And they like him so much backing up the Will and backing up the Sam and backing up the Mike that maybe they won't give him that shot to start. Or maybe they'd be more inclined to move someone ahead of him because they value that versatility so significantly. And I do wonder if that will hurt his ability to get the job, but I've got it as somewhat likely that he will get a shot there. And I think there's some appeal there, especially when you're talking about 10 to 15 snaps a game.
Yeah, I agree. That'd be another one. Kind of what I talked about on Monday's show about Spencer Long is the left guard, just kind of having an economic option that's serviceable. Corey Thompson can be that guy in a role that you don't need to have this, you know, really expensive, pricey player. You're okay. Edmonds and Milano are your linebackers. You're in sub packages most of the time. You know, this is, like I keep saying, a 10 to 15 snap a game player. Bruce, this next player is somebody that I've really been excited to ask you about because I feel I've been pretty outspoken about my beliefs about Vashawn Joseph and that I think he's a backup weak side linebacker and that he doesn't profile well as a Sam linebacker. And I get asked about him a lot in terms of him being able to step in and fill a meaningful role, particularly at Sam linebacker. And if he does, if Vashawn Joseph's the answer at Sam linebacker, people are going to dunk all over me, and they should. Now, I know that you do draft work as well, and I'm sure you got a chance to evaluate him at Florida. That's really all we have. We have some of the preseason last year and what he was at Florida because he missed all year with that shoulder injury. So, Bruce, Vashawn Joseph, the Sam linebacker for this football team in 2020.
I have Vashawn Joseph as highly unlikely and highly unappealing. Not because I don't like Vashawn Joseph. I really like Vashawn Joseph. I really liked him when we picked him, but not as a Sam linebacker in a 4-3 defense. So Vashawn Joseph is the ultimate C-ball, get-ball linebacker. Yes. I liked him as a potential backup to Matt Milano because I think he needs the extra processing time that comes from the weak side position to be able to diagnose. I don't think he's got overly good instincts, so I don't trust him to make split-second quick decisions while running into the line of scrimmage to take on blocks, shed contact, and make tackles. You know, everyone talks about Sam linebacker as somehow that's a, I feel like with the playmaking abilities that you get from a weak side linebacker, sometimes it gets over prioritized as being a more difficult position to play than Sam, which is not necessarily true. It's more difficult from an athletic threshold than Sam, I would argue. But from a mental standpoint, being a Sam linebacker, being able to initiate contact on people you know are coming down, correctly diagnose plays, not get pulled off from play action, you know, not get pulled off from misdirection on the front side, things like this are important with a Sam. And I didn't see any of those things from Vashawn Joseph. Vashawn Joseph is see ball, get ball. And I like that because I thought going into the last draft, man, you know, if Matt Milano goes down, we're really in trouble. And then we drafted Vashawn Joseph. I'm like, good. Thank you. That's perfect. That's exactly what I liked. That's great. And also, if Matt Milano were to leave, then I'd give Vo'Shawn Joseph a crack at the Will linebacker spot because I think that's what he does well. I think he can flow to the ball well. I think he's got good speed. I know his combine testing was, not his combine testing, but his pro day testing was terrible. Remember, he was hurt. He probably shouldn't have even tried to do the testing. It was a disaster. But when you watch the tape, you see an athlete who can run to the ball and tackle. That's not what I want at the Sam. I would be shocked if he got reps at the Sam because it's in no part of his DNA as far as the film evaluation goes. But I still think there's value there. If we don't sign Matt Milano this offseason, Vo'Shawn Joseph is going to become a hot topic. It's can we let him walk? Right now, we don't know because he was hurt last year. But I like Vo'Shawn Joseph, but absolutely not as a Sam.
So they're going to dunk all over me and you. It sounds like Bruce, if he winds up being a viable starter at Sam. And obviously I agree with you a lot there. And you bring in Matt Milano into this equation. And I don't think anybody wants Matt Milano to walk after this season. We all like Matt Milano. He's a good player, but he's a guy that's going to get paid $14, $15 million a year. And when you start thinking about all these extensions that are about to be handed out on this football team, you at least have to think about the replacement if it just doesn't work out because you don't have enough resources to bring everybody back. I know that's not what anybody wants to hear, but I think we have to have realistic thoughts and discussions about that possibility. Next up, Terrell Dotson. I talked about him on last Wednesday as well, briefly at the end, and really interesting player. What, a UDFA out of Texas A&M, was suspended for some, you know, really questionable stuff off the field, and the team stuck with him, Bruce, and they brought him back and put him back on the practice squad. And I don't know, there's some part of me that thinks that the Bills see something in Terrell Dotson. And so we need to consider him as a potential Sam linebacker replacement for Zoe. Your thoughts, please.
For Tyrell Dotson, I have it as somewhat likely and somewhat appealing. I have the exact same archetypes set up for Terrell Dotson as I do for Corey Thompson. And the reason is there's got to be something there on the likely side. I think that when you have a team who hangs on to you, especially a team that preaches the kind of things that the Buffalo Bills do, and you have a team that hangs on to you through some of the issues that we had, it feels like there has to be some idea that we're going to give him a shot at competing for that Sam linebacker spot. In addition to being somewhat likely, he also has some of the size that you don't see from Corey Thompson. Corey Thompson, a low 220s guy. Terrell Dotson, high 230s guy. I think he fits the body type of a Sam a little bit more. And so I think you're going to see a competition this year, assuming we don't add anybody significant in that spot who would walk in the door and go, well, obviously he's going to be the Sam linebacker. I think you're going to see a competition between Terrell Dotson and Corey Thompson. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, Corey Thompson might come in at a slight disadvantage due to his versatility. But I think there's something there with Terrell Dotson. And so I think he can do that thing. I think he can play into the line of scrimmage. All the stuff we just talked about Vo'Shawn Joseph and not being able to do those things, I think Terrell can. And so I have him as somewhat likely and somewhat appealing. I'm interested to see what he's got.
It's interesting. All of the things we've discussed now, whether it was the offense yesterday or defense, this is probably the one spot where we collaboratively agree that there's a realistic in-house option to fill that role. And that's good. You want to be able to do this within your roster because not, like we've talked about a few different times, not every player is going to be a premier player that is a pricey guy. You need certain players to fill roles that are on inexpensive deals. And if the Bills could get quality production from Dotson or Thompson in that role, it'd be a big win for Brandon Bean as he continues to construct this roster. Let's shift gears now to the defensive backfield. And Sean McDermott, a coach who's got a big-time resume of getting production out of defensive backs that aren't necessarily high draft picks. And so there's a couple guys on the roster here that I'm interested to get your take on, not necessarily for a specific role, but that they can claim a meaningful role. Want to start with Jaquan Johnson, the Bills' sixth-round pick out of Miami. Was he a sixth or fifth? I feel like I'm fumbling right now. Sixth round pick out of Miami, Jaquan Johnson. Is there a chance that he can fill a meaningful role for this defense moving forward?
I openly admit my bias. I love defensive backs and I love Jaquan Johnson. So you can probably imagine where this is going. But the first time In both pods, I have someone listed as highly likely and highly appealing. I think that my belief of Jaquan Johnson and the staff's belief of Jaquan Johnson are starting to converge. I think he can be a meaningful player in the defense. I'm not saying he can be a starter, but I was a huge Jaquan Johnson fan. He was one of my favorite picks last year. He was someone where you just loved to watch the film. If you love to watch film, you would love Jaquan Johnson. He has everything you want from a safety, except for this one nagging little problem, and that's he was not blessed genetically. He doesn't run fast. He's not big. He doesn't have long arms. He just did not athletically test well. Coming into the year, people thought high pick for Jaquan Johnson, and he just didn't run well. He was tested a little bit light, a little short. He wasn't quite long enough. And I think that really hurt his draft stock. But make no mind about it, Jaquan Johnson can play. And I'm a huge Jaquan Johnson fan. And as the year started to go along, you started to see Jaquan Johnson mix in a little bit. We knew coming out that at the very least, you're going to get a four-phase special teams player from Jaquan Johnson. You knew that. Worst case scenario, you can do that. He has the instincts you need. He has the physicality that you need to be a great special teams player. But as the year went on, you started to see him a little bit more. And with those shots coming later in the year, I think there's something to Jaquan Johnson. I'm not saying, hey, he's our contingency plan if Jordan Poyer walks. That's not what I'm saying. But I think having him present for multiple safety looks can be valuable. I'll give you a great example. If the Bills play the Ravens again this year, and we all know that a couple keys to that game, Saron Neal, Shaq Lawson, those were big parts of that defensive game plan. Having Jaquan Johnson in place of something like Taron Johnson, the slot. Taron Johnson did not tackle well this year. I don't think I want him in the slot against Baltimore. But if I had Saron Neal on the outside and Jaquan Johnson in the slot, I would feel much better about that side of the line of scrimmage as far as coming up, being physical, playing into the line of scrimmage, making tackles, and making correct instinctual reads, which is what's so important against option offenses. I think that even though he lacks the athletic upside to be able to be a long-term starter, I think he can play meaningful snaps for this defense.
Yeah, definitely some matchup-specific intrigue there when it comes to Jaquan Johnson. So, Bills Mafia, keep an eye on this young man. He was really good in the preseason. It feels like anytime he was given a role, he did it very well. And so, maybe there can be more of that in year two of his career. And you mentioned tackling. And throughout my performance review series, I have been griping about tackles, missed tackles, because I've been bringing up the missed tackle percentage, and I'm just realizing that these Bills defensive players were all in the middle teens, 15, 16, 20% missed tackles. It'd be nice to get a guy in there that can tackle with consistency, and Jaquan Johnson from his tape at Miami, no concerns there. All right, let's talk about cornerback two. Trey White, really outstanding football player, and that's always going to be a challenge for the guy playing opposite of him, because quarterbacks are going to naturally want to go away from Trey White. That means this guy's going to be targeted a lot. And right now, Levi Wallace is an exclusive rights free agent, but that means he'll be back. And do you think he's the CB2 long-term, or do the Bills need to really be mindful of some of his limitations and maybe make an investment there to solidify things opposite of Trey White?
If Kevin Johnson walks, that becomes a need. And I know Bills Mafia probably doesn't want to hear this, but it becomes a significant enough need that cornerback at 22 is on the board. I know you're not going to be happy about that, but having Levi Wallace as your long-term starter at CB2 evokes the same images for me as I just talked about Jaquan Johnson being your long-term starter at safety. He's a good player. He's maximized his athletic gifts, but the gifts that he has maximized aren't significant enough for it to not be able to be taken advantage of by an opposing defense. And that's what Levi Wallace is. Levi Wallace can be a player who can play meaningful snaps for your team. But if you're relying on him down in and down out to cover wide receiver twos who are better now than they probably ever have been, because passing's a more important part of the league than it's ever been, which means there's going to be a more and more emphasis on getting secondary, tertiary weapons on an offense. And as that happens, the counter move is, well, our secondary and tertiary cover guys have to be better. And you can't go in with a CB2 who is, well, he's okay, but, you know, he lacks some athleticism and he gets big boyed. Okay, so what you're saying is you have a corner who starts for you, who struggles against big guys, and he struggles against fast guys. So what would you say you do at that point? You know, okay, as long as the wide receiver two isn't a dynamic player, we're okay. Well, you can't count on that. And so if Kevin Johnson walks away in free agency, cornerback becomes a huge need. Levi Wallace is a rosterable corner in this league, but I don't want him starting opposite Trey White long-term for this defense.
It's funny. I don't want to go off on a tangent here, Bruce, but you said something there that triggered some thoughts within me about being able to hide players, right? Like they're the number two and number three and number four receivers these days are just a whole lot more dynamic, and you're just not going to get away with having a bad player at cornerback too. Just like you used to be able to hide a bad pass blocking offensive tackle at right tackle instead of on the left side. And you can get away with not having much speed on the second level because you have these downhill guys. The way the NFL is trending in terms of style of play is making it impossible to hide anyone anywhere. You got to have good players that have dynamic physical traits. And so when you rely on guys like Levi Wallace, more and more, I think it's going to be a problem.
When you have offensive game planners like Bill Belichick, they will find your weakness and they will plan an entire game around that guy. You can't just hide people. Like you just said, it's offensive game planning has evolved to such a point where no matter what your weakness is, just go in expecting the entire game plan to be focused on that. And this is one of the reasons why Levi Wallace probably could have cut it 20 years ago in the NFL, but he can't now.
Yeah, and it's also never been harder to play defense, right? The way the rules have trended and those types of things. You're not hiding bad players anymore these days. All right, this is one I'm anxious to get into because I want to see if you will challenge me on this, because I've talked about Corey Bohorquez and specialists a lot on this podcast, and I'm not satisfied with Corey Bohorquez. I think even though he set the record for the most punts inside the 20 by a Bills player ever this past year, I don't think there's enough consistency, whether it's the shanks, whether it's inside the 20, but it's at the 17 and the Bills punted from their own 45 and they had a chance to really pin a team deep, but they couldn't get inside the 10, let alone the 5. And I feel like there's another level of consistency that I want out of the punter. Now, Brandon Bean has signed Kari Vedvik to, I guess, compete with Corey Bohorquez. So I guess two questions here, Bruce. Can Kari Vedvik appease my appetite for a good punter? And I guess overall, do I just need to chill out when it comes to talking about punters so often?
Is there a spot below highly unappealing that I can use for this? Can we add like a separate one for this? Now, the only thing that we have as redeeming grace here is that we didn't bring him in as a kicker, because as much as I don't have a really much of a taste for him to be a starting punter for this team, I specifically don't have a taste for him to be kicking for this team, because I watched him kick a lot last year and that was not great. And I would prefer not to see that happen. So I don't think Kari Vedvik is the answer. Now, could he suddenly see a level of consistency that we have not seen from him thus far in his career? Maybe, but you're getting a very similar prospect to Corey Bohorquez, I think. You're getting the powerful leg. You're getting sometimes where he'll crank off a kick and you'll be like, wow, that's a great kick. And then the next three will be terrible. And that's just not good enough. Should you chill on punters? I have good news for you. Continue your crusade, Mr. Marino, because you should not give up the fight and chill on punters. And I will tell you why. So the difference between the best punter in the league and the worst punter in the league is 7 yards average net field position per punt. So let's start with that. Now, depending on where on the field those 7 yards take place, whether it's the 22 to the 27 or the 30 to 37, you're looking at somewhere between 0.4 and 0.6 points per drive difference generated by those 7 yards. That's a lot. The difference between someone who has the best punter in the league and someone who has the worst punter in the league is taking the opposing offense up or down a span of 0.4 to 0.6 points per drive. just for some perspective here, Buffalo was 1.71 points per drive. That was 24th in the league. Which means if the opposing team had the best punter in the league and was able to take us down a notch, we would have fallen all the way to the bottom of the league in points per drive. If the opposing team had the worst punter in the league, we would have gone all the way up to 13th in the league in points per drive. That's the span we're talking about. Now, I understand I'm taking the best to the worst, okay? But let's assume for a second we can just go from terrible to average. That's still somewhere in the neighborhood of 0.25 points per drive, maybe 0.4 points per drive. And that gets us from 24th in points per drive up or down, depending on how the field position hashes out for us. If you're telling me that I can get an average punter, I can spend one draft pick on him in the fourth round, and I can take the opposing offense down four slots in points per drive by using one draft pick on one player, I'm going to do that because that's a significant thing. If I knew going into a matchup that I could take the opposing offense down four notches from, 16th to 20th or from 20th to 24th in points per drive for just that game by spending one fourth round draft pick on a punter, I'm doing that. So no, keep waving the flag, carry the banner, Mr. Marino, because we need better production from a punter and it does have an impact on the game.
Well, maybe some people are disappointed to hear that, but I am fired up, Bruce. I am fired up more than ever. You can expect scouting reports on punters. We're going to find this one this year. I don't know if Brandon Bean's going to agree with me. He hasn't in the past on punters, and he agreed with me on other things, though, but not punters. Maybe we can get on the same page. I'll have a chance to see him this week, and I'll give him some tips on some punters and share that information. Bruce, I really appreciate that information probably more than anything that you've shared here over the last couple of days, but I do want to thank you for being so generous with your time. Two solid, outstanding appearances with me to work through this conversation about the in-house options that I think really solidifies all of the discussion we need to have now to launch forward into off-season mode, free agency, the combines this week, the draft, obviously, in several weeks from now. So we are at a point now where we have covered our bases in terms of examining the internal options, understanding what's on the roster, and really being able to have good discussions moving forward about what the Bills need to do here in the coming weeks to improve and get back to the postseason in 2020. Make sure you guys are following Bruce on Twitter. He's on Twitter at Bruce Exclusive. Obviously, two podcasts with me this week. He's got the Nick and Nolan show coming up later this week. All the written content he already told you about regarding the combine. Now, the on-field workouts start Thursday, and Nick and Nolan, they did a great job at the end of last week on their Thursday and Friday show of talking about the combine and the practical application and what you need to be looking for, what matters, what doesn't matter. So if you want to get ready for that testing, I would definitely encourage you to go back and listen to those podcasts so that way you can come away with the right information from monitoring this combine that is now in prime time. So I'm sure it'll have more eyeballs on it than ever, and we're very thankful that Nick and Nolan gave us the information we need to be ready for it. So Bruce, always appreciate you, my friend. And of course, you won't be a stranger here on this podcast. We'll be bugging you again soon to come back on.
Thanks for having me, man. It's a good time.
All right. That'll do it for us today here on this podcast. Make sure that you share, subscribe, rate, and review. And I'll be back again for you tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening.